In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
It doesn't seem all that long ago that we used to be able to trust our government. We used to be able to trust the various agencies that made up that government. And we used to be able to trust the people we elected to run the government. Oh, sure, they weren't always the best of people. Some were clearly scoundrels. But they were in the minority, and they were outweighed by the majority who helped keep such scoundrels from getting out of line or out of hand. And we had a media that helped us keep an eye on people who were running afoul of what we all agreed were American principles: God, country, family, prosperity, justice, and truth. But somewhere, somehow, our government decided they had become so powerful that trust wasn't necessary anymore. And if there was any trust, the only point to it, from the government's perspective, was it made people easier to control, to keep them from demanding answers and change. It's hard to pinpoint exactly when that all happened. To me, it started when people realized they didn't have to fight government, but rather they could use government, exploit it in their favor, and make a tremendous amount of money by using government. For such people, government stopped being a necessary evil. Government became necessary to commit evil. We saw the first phases in the late 1800s and early 1900s with the so-called robber barons. But before long, it wasn't one-sided anymore, where the super wealthy became even more wealthy through government. The government also realized it could become super wealthy through taxing wealth. And so as each side fed off the other, they became enormous. Through FDR, we saw the rise of the bureaucrat state, and along came World War II, and government got even bigger to protect us. The rise of the intelligence agencies and industrial military complex. Eisenhower warned us. But if he knew about it, why didn't he ever do anything to stop it, other than warn us on his way out the door? And now it's looking for almost certain that the CIA was involved in taking out JFK. Someone who realized the danger of a CIA and other shadowy agencies out of control and tried to do something, until he was killed in broad daylight. And so it went. The agency swelled, and government grew and grew. And then came 2020, when we had the whole of government and the media and big tech unite together again in broad daylight to those paying attention to take out another president. And it was the good guys who stood up. They were the ones who were attacked. Even now, just to ask questions about the obvious problems in the election will get you in trouble or labeled with disinformation by the government. It all makes you wonder just how long we've been naive. Maybe we've always been naive. And it takes a bucket of cold ice water thrown on us from someone who's seen firsthand the dark heart of our government to wake us all up. That's today's guest, a CIA whistleblower. I'd like to welcome Pedro Israel Horta to the show. He is the son of Cuban immigrants who fled the Castro tyranny. Pedro served this country, spending 18 years in the CIA, and when he encountered some problems that endangered his fellow CIA officers, he submitted a whistleblower complaint, which opened the door to him being attacked and punished. He is the author of the book, The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok, which was just published this month. Pedro, it is great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show this evening, Mark. Yeah, appreciate it.
Absolutely. So how did you wind up working for the CIA, especially since by the time you went to work for them, you were already an ordained minister? So what about the CIA attracted you to it?
There's a couple of facets. I've always been intrigued by foreign relations, defense policy, security policy studies, intelligence operations. Growing up in Miami just basically exposed me a lot to, you had the Contra Wars, the Nicaraguans, you had the Afghan, the Mujahideen, all the different things that were happening in the 80s. And that's when I graduated from high school in the 80s. So that really marked me and impressed me. And eventually, first I had to work, and I basically worked full-time in the a variety of different functions, but predominantly perishable commodities in the grocery industry in Miami and floral industry. I marked myself distinctions, did very well, highly praised, But I knew there was more to life, so I finally went back into school. And it was tough, but, you know, going to school at night, working during the day, I managed to graduate from Florida International University with a double major, political science, international relations. And CIA recruiters came to FIU University, and I was able to interview with them. And they basically allowed me to come on board as a graduate fellow so that I can continue studying for a master's degree. And I opted to move to the D.C. area, where I went to George Washington University to study for a Master of Arts in Security Policy Studies. And during the first 2 years, I was actually a graduate fellow from the CIA, but then I converted after 9/11 to a staff officer starting in the analytical branch. And that's pretty much how I got started with the CIA.
And what kinds of jobs did you do with them? I know that your bio there says you did some covert work with them and a bunch of analysis as well. So walk us through some of the jobs that you held there.
Well, I started as an analyst, and I got my career analyst program training. So I was a certified analyst doing analytical work. I was working mostly Latin American issues, counter-drug issues. And after 4 years of doing basically the analytical work at a desk back at the CIA headquarters, I wanted to get back into some kind of field work. And by 2004, we had the Iraq War. And they were looking for people to get out to Iraq, so I volunteered. And I finally make it out to Iraq, where I was on a temporary assignment, working, doing a lot of interagency collaboration work with the military, the CIA, other government departments. And they really liked the job I was doing. So they basically said, you're staying here. You're not going back to headquarters. So they submitted the paperwork to keep me out there. And I remained out there for 2 years doing that kind of work. And that got me more distinctions, more praise. And one thing led to another. When I finished in Iraq, I went back to CIA headquarters to get my operational certification to be able to do the operational tradecraft to conduct human intelligence collections operations. And that led to being deployed out to the field to another semi kind of quasi war zone, where I was doing a lot of counterterrorism work, working with the country officials in that country. Did that for 2 years. And my next assignment took me to Afghanistan as a counterintelligence operations officer, basically making sure people were kept safe from external and internal threats related to security. You know, we had a lot of local nationals. And then, obviously, we had the issue of assets and contacts. And this was immediately after COAST. COAST was when an asset basically detonated. Actually, he wasn't an asset. He was a contact who was being met for the first time. But some things happened, and he blew himself up, killing seven CIA officers and wounding others. So my role in Afghanistan, when I was out there in 2010, was to ensure that we would not have another coast-like incident. And again, another successful tour. Then I went back to CIA headquarters. And at this point, I began doing some technical operations, conducting counterterrorism, targeting Al-Qaeda terrorists for the most part. Distinguished myself, you know. But by that time, I basically had earned 8 exceptional performance awards. I had over 6 years of war zone experiences. I had worked with, you know, multiple leaders in war zones who taught me very well what's expected, what to do, what not to do, so forth. So I went back out to Afghanistan in 2014 as a deputy chief of base.
Right. Before you get to that, we are up against the break, and I know that what you're about to talk about allowed you to see a very dark side of the CIA. This opened the door to that, and it's also why you had to blow the whistle. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Pedro Israel Horta. He is the author of The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Pedro Israel Horta, and he is a former CIA officer, spent 18 years with them, and he later turned whistleblower. And speaking of that, that's kind of where you're headed with that story. I had to interrupt you because of that break, but why don't you go ahead and continue with that?
So yeah, in 2014, December, I went out to Afghanistan as a deputy chief of base. And by that time, I was well-trained, prepared in the leadership mindset as far as what is acceptable, not acceptable. And additionally, we had explicit instructions given to us by multiple briefings, multiple high-level senior officers, and an actual board that gave us our marching orders. So I went out to Afghanistan, and critical position at a critical time. We were in a significant drawdown in transition phase in Afghanistan. And we were there to fight a war. We were there to collaborate with the military, try to help them with whatever information they needed. Meanwhile, also collect information from them, so that we can do our job and, keep our personnel safe and do our functions in that country. But shortly after I got there, I ran into a situation where it potentially could have been another COAST incident. What I mean by that is, in COAST, December 2009, they had an unqualified chief of base who was way out of her element, and some poor decision-making by her part led to that incident that cost her life and the life of six other officers. Well, here I am in 2014, entering into 2015, working for another chief of base who is a lady, nice lady. I had nothing against this lady. I've worked with a lot of qualified women at the CIA who were in operations, were out in the field, but she was not even a field operative. She had been in a different career path, and she was basically out in Afghanistan so she can get her 5 years overseas, so that she can change to a better retirement package. And she had just deployed to Afghanistan after having served in a very plush assignment in Europe for 3 years. She was out of her element, depressed, despondent, missing her three sons, couldn't handle the noise, the dirt, the grime, the long hours, the separation from the family again was the critical issue. And it was one of those situations where she began to cope, and she started adopting sons. The base became a social club where the priority was cooking, baking, social activities.
Wow.
A social club on steroids.
Wow.
And the worst part was the endangerment of our lives through just insanity. We were going out wandering in a large, large base that took a lot of time to cross certain parts, 15, 20 minutes, through areas that were being impacted by rockets, indirect fire.
Wow.
And she was terrified of the indirect fire. I, having worked in war zones before, having seen personnel cope, not cope, adjust, not adjust, and having, worked in with people for all my life in sales. And I was reading the situation. I knew that if I would speak to her, she wouldn't get it, wouldn't understand it. So I at the first instance, I reported it to the psychologist who was responsible for the mental health of the officers overseas. And that led to a very interesting dialogue back and forth with this officer. And ultimately, his suggestion was take it up the chain of command. Well, I did take it up the chain of command, reported it to our supervisor back in Kabul, and he was not pleased at all. It was obvious at one point in time that he had disclosed it to her, and that kind of really spoiled the relationship to a degree. But the worst part about it wasn't that, that he told her, really. The worst part about it was that nothing was resolved and the situation got worse. And eventually I had to talk to her. And exactly as the psychologist and I had concluded, she would never get it. She didn't. In her eyes, she was doing nothing wrong. And I gave her plenty of examples of a particular situation with personnel issues. She was treating a younger officer, the gentleman was probably in his late 20s, like if he was a son. And the priority and the focus was make sure he eats, you know, make sure he gets a break.
Wow.
I actually had to miss meetings because I had to stay back and watch the office so he can basically go cook the, and other stuff like that. But,
well, so I hate to fast forward there. I just know that we're running up on time here. What was the inciting incident that led to you doing the whistleblower?
Well, what happened is the hostile work environment for an older officer. The older officer was maligned, was harassed, was, you know, treated inferior.
Mm.
And eventually the younger officer was taken so much advantage of this older officer that it led to a small little spat, really. I mean, no big deal. It's like, you know, the usual. The younger officer wouldn't do his job, dumped it on the older officer, and they had basically some tense words. And that insulted the chief of base because she had guests in the base. As she said, she was whining and dining and entertaining people. So that created an incident in which she wanted to take punitive actions against this older officer. So I had a very frank, detailed conversation with her again, you know, letting her know everything that had been going on and other things. And I told her, let's resolve this here at the base. Well, she chose to take it to Kabul, to our supervisor, our superior. And that led to an escalation in which this supervisor literally cajoled and coerced me to try to take punitive actions against this older man. And I stood my ground. I said, this older man had done no wrong. He's not a bad man, as you're calling him a bad man. It basically wanted to fire him and send him home. And he is a contractor at that point. He probably would have been terminated and probably never would have gone back and work anymore as a contractor for the CIA. And there were other issues there where the chief of base had falsely accused this older man of drawing a weapon at one point in time, which he never did. So I speaking up, disclosing these matters, led to a barrage of reprisals from the chief of base against me.
Hmm.
That led me to go straight to the chief of station and report things to this chief of station.
You know, let's actually stop there because I know our audience is going to want to hear what happened to you when you're just trying to resolve the issue and you're following proper procedure by filing a whistleblower complaint, and yet you're the one that ends up getting punished. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Pedro Israel Horta after this. And welcome back. We're talking to Pedro Israel Horta. He is a former CIA officer and turned whistleblower. And you were describing that incident there, how this chief there was basically deriding an older officer who probably knew way more about the situation than she ever would. But go ahead and talk to us about the reprisal. Well, talk to us about what exactly you filed it for and then the reprisal that you faced.
Well, what happened there was the situation became so toxic that the best thing I could do was pull back, disengage, and take a break. We were entitled to some breaks of about almost 3 weeks. So at that point in time, the discussion with the chief of station was, I take a break. On my way out of the country, I had a 45-minute video teleconference with the chief of station, the deputy chief of station, the chief human resources officer, to go over everything. And the last words I had from the chief of station was, go home. And we'll sort this out and get back to you. I go home. A week after I'm home, I get a call to go to CIA headquarters. When I go to CIA headquarters, at that point in time, I find myself at first with a meeting with an anti-harassment officer in the Office of Equal Employment Opportunity because I had sent him everything. And this officer doesn't want to hear anything about these issues and tells me, just go to the meeting that you're called to. I go to the meeting. When I get to the meeting, I'm told that I will not be going back to Afghanistan. I asked about a specific job in another place in Afghanistan because there was an opening, and I'm told you're not going back to Afghanistan, but you can apply to any job you want, and you're free to take whatever job you want. I go home. A week later, I'm again in contact with the EEO officer. He wants to hear nothing about it. Basically told me it's a good thing you got fired. You can reinvent yourself. The week goes by. I'm still trying to get some clarity as far as what's going on. And eventually I called in again to extend my leave for a week. And I realized that this thing is going all the way up the chain of command, very high up. And the day comes for me to go to the office.
Do you know if she was instigating things behind the scene to try to escalate this rather than just letting it go?
Well, what happened is, as soon as I get back to the office, I had filed a whistleblower reprisal complaint with the inspector general. I accidentally blew the whistle. I didn't even know I was a whistleblower. You're required by law to report wrongdoing. That's an act of blowing the whistle. And if you do, you're protected by law. So when I get back and I finally find out what's going on, I find out that she had basically totally trashed my reputation, made up all sorts of lies about me, about my leadership, so forth, calling me a troublemaker, you know, poor leadership, poor communication, poor this, poor that. And they justified ending my tour under that predicate that I was unqualified and I was a troublemaker and I had poor communication. I created a hostile work environment. And with that, they basically closed the door on my career as a director of operations officer.
Wow.
They made it impossible for me to find any job. EEO was not helping. They wouldn't help me locate evidence that proved my claims. They were doing everything they can to try to kill the EEO complaint. Mind you, I told them, all I want is a job in another war zone, or a six-month trip to a war zone.
Well, and what's kind of disgusting about this whole situation is you're in a war zone, and this should be a situation where she's not having baking parties. It should be about maintaining the safety and security of her base and ensuring that the officers have everything that they need to get the jobs done, you know, whatever it is that they're assigned to, and yet this is happening, and so you're having to deal with this kind of garbage rather than the actual assignments you were sent there to do.
Yeah, the IG wouldn't help at all. Human resources wouldn't help. I basically got chased out of the CIA. I actually took 2 months of leave without pay. That's just how toxic the situation was. Mm. And I took what's known as a joint duty assignment, where I went to work for another government agency, the Office of Director of National Intelligence, specifically the Office of Inspector General for the Intelligence Community. And when I finally get back to work, well, they denied me access to everything. I had no access to anything other than email. When I went back to headquarters during that whole entire period, all I can see is email. I couldn't see any operational tradecraft, any administrative cable, nothing. So when I finally get back to work, the Office of Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, and I find out what happened, they literally tailored all base operations and personnel for her social club clique.
Hmm.
And, you know, this is just how this all began.
Well,
and from there on, again, it just goes downhill.
Well, what you're describing sounds like a really toxic workplace in many ways, and one that's highly politicized, where if you know the right people, like she apparently did, she can get her way rather than actually focusing on the job. And of course, like I just said, that's the important thing that you're all supposed to be doing, and yet this kind of garbage is going on. Let's go ahead and take a break a little bit early. We're going to have more with Pedro Israel Horta. He is a CIA whistleblower, and after spending 18 years with them, he's got a new book, The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Pedro Israel Horta. He is the son of Cuban immigrants that fled the Castro tyranny. He served this country, spending some 18 years in the CIA, and ended up blowing the whistle on them as well. You were trying to resolve an issue, and that station chief there was making things worse. or the base chief anyway. So I guess my question is, to hear you describe all of this, how systemic is this within the CIA, these kinds of problems?
Well, what I uncovered was the cover-up was the problem. It's bad enough that they're taking reprisals against a whistleblower, but the fact that they're trying to do everything they can to bully and beat a whistleblower until that whistleblower will either quit or retires in place where they just shut up, it's their goal. And if you don't do that, eventually what they'll do is they'll find a way to fire you. So I ended up basically uncovering this criminal conspiracy, call it what it is, to deprive EEO complainants of their civil rights, due processes, whistleblowers alleging reprisals of their same legal rights. There's a presidential policy directive 19 that on paper protects a whistleblower from having to suffer any reprisals. So I find out that basically we have protections on paper, but they don't enforce them. They actually will try to bully and beat you. And the ironic thing about this entire case is that it could have easily have been resolved, but by not resolving it, it led to more escalation. And landing in the office of Inspector General for the Intelligence Community, the year after I'm there, I'm working on a team that is working on evaluating whistleblower protections. I'm actually looking at these protections that I'm supposed to have. And we find out that, again, it's just basically ink on paper. They're not enforcing the protections. They don't know what standards to enforce. You've got IGs basically plotting to not even enforce the protections. You have senior level officials in that Inspector General office undermining those protections. And ultimately, our findings were that they're not enforcing or implementing the protections. They did not like that, so they tried to kill the report. And they were trying to pressure us to change our findings, but we wouldn't budge. I mean, we stuck to our findings because we had the data to prove it. So they found a way to kill the report. They blamed that the evaluation was contaminated, tainted by I being a member of the team working on it, because I was a whistleblower and I had alleged reprisals.
Wow.
Particularly with a lawsuit that my attorney filed. The attorney I had at the time filed a lawsuit to compel the CIIG to do its investigation because the CIIG would not do its investigation. By law, they were required to do an investigation within 240 days.
So let me interrupt you here. The notion that you're a whistleblower, you get put in the IG's office on a committee investigating whistleblower complaints. They then use the fact that you're a whistleblower to kill this investigation. Were you assigned there on purpose as kind of the stool pigeon, I guess, in order to kill that investigation?
No. It's just I needed to find a safe place to work in that particular office. I had gone to that office twice. And I saw the personnel that were there. I saw who my colleagues would be, and it would be interagency work. And I've always had a stellar work history doing interagency work. So it was a perfect fit for me to get away from the CIA, go find someplace safe to work. And it's just by chance I happened to be put on a team that was doing a whistleblower protections evaluation.
So to be clear, you're investigating not just whistleblower complaints from within the CIA, but it's across the intelligence community. Is that correct?
We weren't looking at whistleblower reprisal complaints. We were looking to see if the agencies and the IGs were implementing the protections that were put in writing by law, to see what kind of standards, policies, and procedures they were following. So we were looking at the implementation of those protections.
Okay, so you're a whistleblower, and you're investigating whether or not these procedures are being followed, and you're looking at, firsthand, you're looking at these complaints from others that have been filed. How many of those would you estimate ended up being killed or just done away with? I mean, the complaint, not the person.
Well, I mean, basically, two things. One, through delay tactics, they would hope that a complainant would quit
And if a complainant would quit, they would immediately cancel the whistleblower reprisal investigation, sure, saying, well, the person left, so there's nothing to investigate.
Right.
They're gone. By law, that's actually wrong. They're still supposed to investigate it. So that was wrong by the IGs to do that. And secondarily, there's a news article out there, Daily Beast put out, apparently details of this leaked out. It turns out that, you know, I think it was only 1 out of 195 was actually adjudicated in favor of a whistleblower who alleged reprisals. Basically, your chances of winning the lottery are greater than your chances are to file a whistleblower reprisal complaint and having it fully investigated and adjudicated in a timely basis. Because that was, we can say, a third issue. A third issue was they were not even meeting the time standards. And by failing to meet the time standards, they rendered the protections moot, of no effect.
They just run out the clock, yeah.
You run out the clock. Evidence perishes, people forget, people move on, you can't find somebody. So you would have cases that an IG would say, well, we did not substantiate the reprisal. That actually did not mean that a reprisal did not take place. That means the IG couldn't find a reprisal because they failed to do their due diligence to fully investigate on a timely basis.
We're getting close to a clock break here, so let's go ahead and do that. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Pedro Israel Horta. He is a whistleblower from the CIA, and his new book out there is The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok. It was just published this month. You'll want to get that. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to a CIA whistleblower. That is Pedro Israel Horta. And his new book is The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok. It's available on Amazon. It just came out this month. I've read that first chapter. Hope to have Pedro back here either next week or maybe sometime soon thereafter. This has been a fascinating discussion, a look at what actually happens to whistleblowers. You know, whistleblowers are there for a reason. They're there to expose malfeasance. They're there to expose abuses in the system, and it's designed to not just protect the system, but improve the system. And yet you're going through all of this. And so you had gotten kicked off of that committee that was looking at these other whistleblower complaints and as to whether or not the standards and procedures were being followed. So why don't you pick up that story from there? What happened next?
Yeah, they claimed I had a conflict of interest and they sent me back to CIA. But the strange thing is there were two other whistleblowers in that office. And one of them,
yeah, but they must be the right kind of whistleblowers.
But they were like the chief of all the whistleblower stuff.
Hmm.
So they sent me back, and I go back basically to round two of more CIA reprisals. I went back, and I encountered the same roadblocks, stumbling blocks, denial of jobs, getting nowhere, applications for work being tampered with. A job denial directly attributed to the bad performance review from Afghanistan in 2015. And in this process, now I begin to blow the whistle on the broken whistle.
Hmm.
So I'm beginning to basically escalate by going to the IG himself, or the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community. I sent him an Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act disclosure with firsthand information as far as what I have witnessed. And my disclosure to him goes nowhere.
Hmm.
When I follow up, no response. Now, by this time, I'm working with an attorney. That's a whole different story. But through the attorney, we find a way to get Congress interested because of the lawsuit. It was faxed to several congressional members. I tip off the attorney about my congressional disclosures that never made it to Congress. So Congress begins inquiring. And now I've got the CIA threatening me, hey, you're not supposed to talk to Congress unless you go through us or you could be terminated. But Congress is able to get some of those congressional disclosures, but the CIA refused to send everything, telling me we don't send those kind of things to the Congress. So here they're telling me that they keep stuff away from Congress. And, you know, I'm getting nowhere as far as finding a job. The IGs are being totally obstructionist in anything to do with these protections and these processes and these procedures. So I continue to escalate. I begin to blow the whistle to Pompeo himself through his number three. This is Director Mike Pompeo for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
I went up as high as his number three, Brian Bulatau, which is his buddy. He put in as the number three of the CIA. They basically refer me back to the IG, the IG ombudsman, and they put out a nice anti-harassment policy. If you ever see harassment, report it. We'll take care of it.
And unless it's actual harassment, then not so much.
So, you know, so it continues to escalate. Nothing's happening. No one is doing anything. I'm having to take a job that is basically not career enhancing. My career is dead. My name is like toxic waste. When it's the performance review session, the person that's supposed to represent me in the performance board told me nobody will talk to him about me. Whenever he asks a question, it was you can drop a pin and it's just silence.
Hmm.
So at this point, I escalate to the Director of National Intelligence, Daniel Coates himself, letting him know that the whistle is broken. The whistleblower process, the regime, protections, everything is completely broken with the IG's failing to implement. You know, you're basically subjecting yourself to a tyrannical regime hell-bent on destroying you. Eventually, I file another disclosure. In this process, again, no response from the ICIG. Squat, zero, nada. I reported to the Director of National Intelligence, the Deputy Susan Gordon. She admits that there's problems with the IGs, encourages me to report it to the IG Oversight Board. At this moment in time, I guess the CIA realizes they have a serious problem. So they send in the CIA Office of Security like a goon squad, like a mafia hitman to basically kick me out. And they hatched a plot. I call it Salvatore's Christmas Massacre. On December 19th, when there's no one around that can help, the CIA Office of Security basically put out a be on the lookout list and denied me entry to a building. And at that moment in time, I went on administrative leave. And that began a different phase of the whistleblower.
I assume when you said goon squad just then, it was somewhat facetiously, but did you ever feel threatened? Like, I mean, they might escalate this even further just to get rid of you? I mean, perhaps even physically get rid of you.
Well, they did. You know, the Director of Security sent one of his deputies as a like a mafia enforcer, warning me, hey, be lucky you have a job. We can take the job away from you. You better quit complaining, and you better be happy with the job you have.
Yeah. And this guy was saying these things to you?
Yes.
It's not just
not
implied.
Directly,
it's,
but indirectly.
I see.
Meanwhile, at the same time, the Office of General Counsel is denying me getting a new attorney. And some really questionable tactics by the Office of General Counsel that potentially could be criminal in nature.
Hmm. So you're there. Your ethics are keeping you there in this fight, I assume, because you're trying to get this situation resolved. You've raised a complaint, and you're not letting go because you want this to be resolved. I imagine part of that is, you know, if this happened to you, you're imagining that this is going to happen to other people. Did you ever think, you know, maybe I should just give in? Or what would happen if you just said, you know, I'm just going to withdraw that complaint and we'll both wash our hands of this?
Well, what happened is throughout this latter process, more information came out that there were other whistleblowers who had alleged that the process was broken and that they had been reprised against for reporting on these broken processes. Three whistleblowers, in fact.
You know, we're up against the clock. This sounds really interesting. And so let's come back on that, these other whistleblowers that you became aware of. Everyone stay with us. We will be wrapping things up here with Pedro Israel Horta. His book is The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok. And welcome back. And our fellow subject now here on the iSpire Radio Show. This is show number 1409. If you're looking for that on iSpireRadio.com, and we're going to have some links up to his book, which is The Broken Whistle, A Deep State Run Amok. And we're talking to Pedro Israel Horta. And so you run into these other whistleblowers. What happens next?
Well, it turns out that I'm not the only one who has filed complaints about these whistleblower process being broken. And the CIA IG itself, with the leader, the chief, and the deputy, were under investigation for taking reprisals against some of those whistleblowers.
Hmm.
So this is all coming out at this time. And I'm now out of the CIA, and more congressional disclosures were filed. And eventually what happens is the Office of Security puts me through what I call the kangaroo court, because it's a board, and the board makes a recommendation, but the recommendation goes to the Office of Security, who has the final say, and they don't have to listen to what the board says. Ultimately, the Office of Security makes the final determination.
So it's pretty much like our Department of Justice is what it sounds like. Lack of.
Well, I mean, the Office of Security officer that came after me told me, I will take your clearance away from you and I will get you fired.
Wow.
So basically, and that's what he did, to make a long story short. But what happens now is eventually I get notified of my termination in July, but it's not effective until September, but I have appeals. And in this process, I contact the Office of Inspector General Intelligence Community again, because now they finally have a new Inspector General. And they tell me to file the Form 401, a form that requires firsthand information. So they tell me to refile the disclosure that I had filed previously. So what happens is, in this entire process, you know, I'm fired. I'm more concerned working through my appeals first. My last day was the end of September, and, you know, they haven't answered my last appeal.
September 2018.
Yes.
Right.
And finally, my last appeal is, they notify me in January of 2019. That's when I finally am officially notified that I was terminated. And there's a lot more shenanigans that happened with the Office of General Counsel and me getting approvals for an attorney. They finally approve them after I was fired. And after I was fired, when the attorney contacts him, tell him, well, he was fired. We got nothing to discuss about the case. Yeah, really just shenanigans. So I finally file the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act using Form 401, which is that infamous form that got changed to accommodate the hit against Trump.
Right.
In September 2019. I filed them in February and March of 2019. This time, the ICIG immediately responds like in the snap of a finger, telling me, well, you've been fired. You're no longer an employee, so you don't have a right to file these disclosures. There's nothing we can do for you. Yeah. Consequently, fast forward to September 2019, and now we find out that, you know, there's this Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act disclosure against Trump, that Trump has done some wrong, that he's violated the law. You've got Congress jumping on board trying to help this whistleblower. This disclosure is moving forward at the speed of light, literally, with the IG himself involved in it and pushing forward with it. And it turns out that they had changed the form and watered it down to be a hearsay allegation. So they're not willing to process a firsthand allegation that had been filed multiple times, but now they're willing to file a hearsay allegation against the president. So it's more like, don't you dare report wrongdoing about what we're doing wrong. We don't want people to know about our dirty laundry. We don't want people to know that we're corrupt as hell itself. But go ahead and you can blow the whistle against President Trump, and we will protect you, nice. Congress and everyone else, the IGs will defend you, and we'll have your back.
Yes.
So I was fired, terminated, no help from anybody, no help from Congress. Meanwhile, you know, the Ukraine whistleblower is treated like a hero, while we, yes, the real whistleblowers, treated like villains.
So in that first chapter of your book was just fascinating. In fact, I had forgotten that they had changed that form retroactively in order to allow that whistleblower complaint to go through. I had forgotten that it was supposed to be a first-person account, not something secondhand, and I had forgotten that the entire intelligence community got behind, I forget the name of the guy that got on Maria Bartiromo's show and said, well, this was never should have gone through. The guy did not have the correct legality to be able to file this complaint to begin with, and the higher-ups that allowed it to go through, they were out of line as well. And I forgot then that the entire intelligence community came in behind him to support him for doing this, to violate their own rules in order to let that go through. So that was That was really enlightening to see that. And, you know, I'm listening to you talk here. You're talking about the weaponization of something, again, that is supposed to expose problems within a system that is designed to improve the system. I mean, that's the point of these whistleblower complaints. It's not to necessarily to get somebody in trouble. It's to say, hey, there's a problem here. We need to fix this. How public was your fight at that point? And how many other whistleblowers out there do you think were watching that and saying, I'm never going through that?
A couple things. I mean, because I was undercover, I wasn't able to be very public about it until I was finally fired and I had my cover rolled back. At that point, I can speak out. There are other whistleblowers, and in fact, this is why it's important. Intelligence failures do happen, and lives are put at risk. 9/11, for example. But there's another case out there of a whistleblower by the name of John Reedy. He reported, allegedly, some serious technical problems that instead of fixing the problem, they chose to cover it up and take reprisals against him. And this may have cost the lives of dozens of assets, if these press reports are accurate, which they appear to be. So, I mean, at the same time, you know, one of the whistleblowers who had reported the issue with the CIA IG in taking reprisals against him and in not enforcing the whistleblower reprisal protections happened to be the attorney for one of the whistleblowers against Trump. But the interesting thing about this case is eventually his case is probably one of the only cases that another IG fully investigated and found that reprisals were taken against him for having reported that the whistle is broken.
Wow. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. And we would love to have you back on to talk more about the CIA itself, digging into the deep state and the attacks against Trump. And hopefully we can get that arranged here real soon. Pedro, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. And there's a lot more that makes it even more interesting.
We are trying to get Pedro on, but as of this moment, we're not sure if our schedules will mesh for this next week or the week following. But speaking of such things, now might be a good time to sign up for our weekly email show notices. On Fridays, we send out a promo email letting you know what's coming up that weekend. Just send an email to info@ispyradio.com, info@ispyradio.com. If you enjoyed today's show, let others know. The time for all of us to be silent is over, so be the information hero of your circle of family and friends. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.